aren't all in yet, but on the basis of your present judgment, where would you pin down the control problem? To the horizon scanners that reset the gyros, to the gyros, or to that reaction jet that didn't appear to be working?
I think it was a combination of things. I think we had a little bit of thruster trouble. I think we, on the horizon scanners, I'm not sure. I think that perhaps some of the horizon scanner trouble could have been eliminated had we gone to a free gyro position. We didn't do this. We were still getting our horizon scanner inputs. This may possibly have added to our troubles. It's easy, though, to hindsight this 2020 after you're on the ground. But we're still looking into these things.
Gentleman with the wavy hair right here.
Frank,
Could you tell me what the highest cabin temperature was you experienced
during your flight? Question is, what was the highest cabin temperature? I think the onboard cabin temperature, about the highest I observed, was about 105. This is, once again, we're checking telemetry records, and we'll probably have more accurate information on that later on.
Yes, sir, Mr.
I assume you've had an ophthalmological examination, and I wondered if the physicians have found any cosmic ray tracks in the lenses of your eye, and if so, how dense are they?
The question was whether I had had a complete eye examination following this flight, whether there had been any cosmic ray indication of damage to the eyes. Where's Bill Douglas? I think he should answer all this on the medical.
Dr. Douglas,
medical there? Information.
Where no damage, he says.
I didn't ask whether there was damage. I asked if there were any tracks.
Dr. Douglas, any tracks?
No tracks.
No tracks.
No tracks in the eyes.
I'd like to ask two questions, Colonel Glenn. First of all, elaborate preparations were made prior to the flight and during the flight to ascertain certain facts with regard to international records. First of all, what records were we after and what will we claim in the way of records? And the other is, what pictures did you manage to take? Have they been developed? And what do they show, if anything, and will we get them?
Private press conference?
I'll see you later.
Let me talk about the records first, the international flight records.
The international flight records, I didn't go into this in any great detail as to all the flight records that might be claimed as a result of something like this. We understood that there had been some question of verification during the some of the earlier orbital flights. And I have no comment on that one way or the other. They wanted to adequately verify these flights. I was busy enough with preparations, I didn't worry too much about our certification, I'm afraid.
Peter, I might say that the FAI did witness the flight. They had witnesses on both ends. They have acquired the proper certificates, and we will turn our data over to them. How about the pictures, John?
Pictures were taken of general views of different land areas, areas that were particularly clear, Florida here, the lower eastern, southeastern part of the United States, taken from an angle, Africa, the desert area, many cloud pictures, many sunrise pictures. I tried to get pictures of the little glowing objects I described. Apparently they were not of sufficient intensity to come through, at least on the first look that we took at some reproductions of the pictures the other day. And as to when these will be released, I have no idea. We're still looking at them.
Mr. Burwell.
In taking the high forces of deceleration after the period of weightlessness, did you experience any noticeable difference to the acceleration during the powered flight?
The question was whether we noticed any difference in the accelerative effects on the body as opposed to the decelerative effects on the body at the end of the flight as a result of this period of weightlessness, and I could notice no effects at all. This felt just the same on reentry as our runs on the centrifuge where we were practicing reentry, for instance. Got up to about 8 G's, and this is a very tolerable level.
transport with the body in the couch the way we are, and had no ill effects from it at all. At 8 G's, you're not just lying back relaxed. You're working against it. But we have all been up in the neighborhood of 14 to 16 G's previously on the centrifuge, so 8 G's is not intolerable at all.
Mr. Lurie?
General Glenn, two questions. One, can you be just a little bit more specific on when you got the indication of trouble with the heat shield? We were told that it was in the first orbit, and I'd like to know if it was in the first or second orbit. Secondly, apparently there was some discussion about aborting the mission after the second orbit, or ending the mission prematurely. I was wondering if you can tell us about this and whether it was on your decision that they went on into a third orbit.
Well, see, the first question was whether I could be more specific on when I had information that we might have heat shield trouble. I really don't recall. Do you recall, Al, you were on Cap? What? That was just before retro.
That's on the third orbit.
Yeah, but
we knew about it on the ground
before. People in the control center knew about it much earlier in the flight. I think perhaps the first you knew about it, John, was down into the third orbit.
Well, you knew it, I believe, at the end of the first orbit. I think they knew it at the end of the first orbit. Don't pin me down on this one, but I believe they knew it at the end of the first orbit. And I think there were questions put out to me about it during that second orbit, about whether I had a light indication or not. This is, once again, we'll play back the tapes and we can pin it down almost to the second. I don't believe this was of any significance, however. The second part of your question was, what was it?
Whether you were going to terminate the flight at the end of two orbits.
Terminate the flight at the end of two orbits. There was a decision to be made there because we had had some control system problems. At that time, I think the control center felt that we had the capsule under fine enough control that we would gain nothing by re-entering at that time. I felt the same way. My recommendation was that we were still in a go status. And they agreed we were still go, so we went for three orbits. If anything, at a time like that, if you are going to have to make a manual retrofire, you might as well stay up a while and get more practice.
Mr. Bergman.
Jules Bergman, ABC News. John, you said, boy, that was a real fireball as you started the reentry process. Can you describe to us your sensations as you started and during reentry and the kind of controlling you were doing during reentry to the chute opening?
The sensations during reentry, during the fireball, I guess you'd say cautious apprehension or something like that. Now, this is an unknown area, of course, so we've had very little experience with a man inside the a glowing fire like this that you can see outside the window. We have confidence that the ablation shield will take care of this. It did. But this is a completely new experience, and you're a little apprehensive of it at the time, I think. Oh, kind of control was damping. It was not controlling to a specific attitude. As the capsule would set up oscillations, you just try and damp them out and keep the thing to as near a zero rate as you can. The only movement the capsule is making, you do have a constant roll rate put in at that time of about 10 degrees per second, which gives us our even flight path as you come down so that you don't get any dispersion from CG being a little off location.
Back here, sir.
Colonel, how large a view did you have at any one time? For example, could you see all of Florida and more in one glance?
Yes, you can. Well, when I was well off the east coast here once, I could see back across Florida, and I remember stating I could see the Mississippi Delta at that time. It was pretty clear along the Gulf Coast. Your view to the horizon is about, approaches 900 miles.
Mr. Detter?
I've heard, Colonel Glenn, that when you go automatic on your control system, that you use your hydrogen peroxide at a greater rate, and therefore when you switch, you're actually saving your hydrogen peroxide. Does this hamper you, restrict your other duties, or do you think in the future this the man could fly by wire and still perform all the methods he's done?
The question was whether when we go on manual control and switch back and forth from automatic to manual, whether we waste fuel doing this, since the capsule drops into this high torque orientation mode. Was that what you were referring to? The answer to that one is you don't drop into this high torque mode if you position the capsule accurately on your orbit attitude that you want to begin with before you switch over. If you switch over to automatic mode when you're way out at some oddball attitude, then it kicks into this high torque mode, uses fuel at a rather rapid rate, so you don't want to do that too many times. If when you're on manual, though, you position this accurately before you switch back to automatic, you use no more fuel than you would normally.
Young lady in the back here, sir.
Colonel Glenn, did you observe anything that was at variance with the reports of the two Russian cosmonauts?
Well, I don't know that we've had real complete reports from the Russian cosmonauts on what they observed or saw or felt. We've had some reports. I don't believe I'd care to comment on it any further than that. I think probably this will be the subject of more discussion as we learn more about their programs. Perhaps we should ask them. Our program is completely open. Theirs is a secret one. They can compare with what I saw.
Jack Norris.
Colonel, can we get back to the Firefly? Did you have any point of reference to measure these, estimate the size of these, or conceivably could they have been much larger farther away?
No, I don't think so, because I could see come drifting up very close to the window and come in the shadow of the capsule, and they'd lose most of their luminescence as they came into this shadow area right close to the capsule. You could see them right just outside the window. You could see the little diameters. Also, you could look off to the side, and as you move through this field of particles or whatever it was, you could see them changing relative position to the capsule as you went by, and this gives you a sort of a depth perception.
About four more minutes. Yes, sir.
Richard Lewis, Chicago sometimes. Colonel, could you elaborate on the report that you saw some orange and blue bands at sunset as you would go into the sunset?
Yes, you do. You see, the question is whether I had orange and blue bands visible at sunset. Whenever these pictures are released, I think they'll show some of this. As the sun goes down, it's very white, brilliant light. And as it goes below the horizon and you get your light coming to you then through the atmosphere, it's a very bright orange color down close to the surface. It pales out into sort of a blue, a darker blue, and then off into black. It's like looking at a spectrograph, pretty much, if you've ever done that. It just broadens out your whole, takes your white light and broadens it out into all of its color elements, and that's just about what you see. It's not quite like a rainbow, but it's... this is the same principle involved anyway.
Mr. Kokum.
Larry Kokum, Aviation. How long do you control fly by wire on the planet? How long on complete manual?
How long did I control on fly by wire and how long on manual? This is something we want to total out. It was for very extended periods of time. The last, practically all of the last two orbits, I was on either fly by wire or manual, so there'll be. Maybe an hour and 15 minutes average for each control mode, but that's not a real definitive statement. We have to total these times out when we get the records analyzed.
Mr. Livermore.
What was the noise level,
please,
inside the capsule in orbit?
What was the noise level?
Noise level of the capsule in orbit was very similar to what it is on the pad out here. You have the whine of the inverters, the gyros, valves, the hiss of the oxygen in the helmet hose. It's not a loud intensity. I don't know what the decibel level of it is exactly, but it didn't appear to be any different in orbit than it is out here when we're running checks on the pad.
Mr. Neal.
John, can you give us some idea of your schedule for the next few days, and particularly, when do you have to get back to work?
Wow. Question is about my schedule for the next few days and when I'm going to get back to work. I don't know. I think our schedule for the next few days is a little bit vague at the moment. I don't know what we're putting out on that.
The Speaker of the House has invited Colonel Glenn and all of the astronauts and their wives to a joint session of the Congress on Monday.
NASA official James Webb.
As to whether all wish to go or can go, but certainly Colonel Glenn will be there, I think, because he has been invited to address the joint session. Beyond that, it is planned to have a press conference in Washington for the Washington press following a luncheon which the Vice President and I will give on Monday. Beyond that, there is a plan that the four astronauts who have not yet flown will continue with that program. And the mayor of New York has invited Colonel Glenn and Commander Shepard, Kevin Grissom, and Bob Gilruth up to receive the welcome of the city, to have a parade to be received in City Hall by His Honor the Mayor. All of this sort of in a tentative or somewhat definite planning stage. We're going to have a conference right after this meeting with all the astronauts to see what their desires are. Dr. Dryden, Dr. Siemens, and I are going to meet with Bob Gilruth here and then fly back together tonight to try to figure out precisely what the situation is. I may say that the mayor of St. Louis has asked for urgently that I bring Alan Shepard with me there tomorrow, where I'm going to make the Founders Day address at Washington University. Again, this is a subject we'll discuss after this meeting.
Mr. Simmons, one last question.
Any other questions about my schedule?
Last question.
Simmons, I'm noticing. No. Colonel Glenn, did you hear Commander Shepard advise you to try to jettison your retro pack when you reach 1 to 1.5 G's on the reentry?
No, I did not. And this occurred just at the beginning of communications loss. And the reason we know this is last night, after we had finished some meetings, we finally had copies of the onboard recorder tape. And we played these over last night rather late and went through the reentry. And Al comes on the air just at the start of this communication and starts to tell me to jettison this. And the people that were listening with me said that is what he went ahead and said. He's about halfway through his transmission, it fades right out to nothing, and I never received it. If we had had 3 more seconds, I guess, of time before we got our communications blackout during reentry, I would have received the message. Oh. Yes, the straps were gone by then anyway. The straps burned off when we had, I estimated, not over half G on the capsule. It was early in the program.
Okay, we'll stop on the hour. Mr. Lurie?
Colonel Glenn, your wife showed us this morning the pin that you gave her, the Mercury Orbital Friendship 7. I was wondering if you had any other personal effects with you in the capsule.
None to speak of.
Yes, sir.
Did you use the little red lights at the ends of your fingertips on your gloves?
Yes. Did I use the little red lights we had on the fingertips and the gloves? I found these very handy. These were, I could turn them on and off with a little switch on the back of the hand. Their little fingertip lights, a very small bulb. For looking at charts, for checking the map and the type capsule lighting we have, these turned out to be very handy, and I use them repeatedly. I like them very much. I'm glad we decided to put them on.
Yes, sir. Way in the back there, young lady. Mary Bob.
Mary Bob, what can I do? I would like to know if it hasn't been determined again or whether you'll have to wait to go through the data as to whether the heat shield was actually in danger of becoming loose or whether it was actually a false signal.
No, it was a false signal. I think this has been reasonably well determined now that it was a false.
We know. I guess it was day before yesterday, Walt, before you came over to GBI, that it was a malfunctioning limit switch that gave a false signal. The heat shield was securely latched all the time we were worrying so.
On the far side.
Roger Sharp, ABC.
Colonel, if we could get back to your schedule rather briefly once again, and perhaps Mr. Webb could comment. Do you have any plans to go outside of the United States, or would you object to being utilized in the way that Major Gagarin was?
Well, I think this gets into a little different field than I'm qualified to comment on right now. We may have to discuss some things like this in the future. I think there are no plans immediately that I know of.
May I say just this word there? Obviously, this program has many implications for the total image of the United States abroad. We, of course, want to learn all we can about space. We want to learn to use men in space. But we must be conscious of these other implications. These questions will be debated with great care. Colonel Glenn and the other astronauts will be consulted with respect to the workout of the plan, and I think you can expect, though, more activity in the past. As a matter of fact, I told Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom this morning that after the New York parade, if they wanted to have some time out of jail, they'd be not under the same restrictions they have been in the past. Now, I believe I forgot to mention the fact that Colonel Glenn's hometown is very anxious to have him on Friday after the New York parade. But I think all of this will come out pretty soon, yeah, after the decisions have been made. Obviously, he is going to decide himself what he wants to do.
We're out of time. Thank you very much.
Astronaut John H. Glenn, Jr., telling his own story of his great space journey around the world. Still looking mighty fit after a morning of really strenuous ceremonies, including a parade cheered by some 100,000 persons down here at Cocoa Beach, Florida, as well as Cape Canaveral, a presentation of a presidential medal by President Kennedy. Glenn stepped to a platform before several hundred newsmen here in a circus tent set up at the Cape Canaveral press site, where reporters covered the flight. It seemed so long ago, but it was only last Tuesday. The only persons beside Lieutenant Colonel John Glenn on the platform, and whose voices you heard conducting the news conference, were James E. Webb, administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and Robert R. Gilruth, Project Mercury director. The conference started at 1:54 this afternoon, just about 1 hour and 6 minutes, just crammed full of real fascinating talk by America's first astronaut. Also on the platform was the man that we reporters call the eighth astronaut, Lieutenant Colonel John Shorty Powers, the voice of Mercury Control. A new phrase came into being today. Colonel Glenn talked about not having any go fever, referring to the long waits, and he did get a laugh at one point on a very fascinating portion of his journey. He talked about the mysterious glowing objects he noticed every time he went from night into day as he passed across the Pacific. Still unexplained objects. Lieutenant Colonel Glenn said, the NASA psychiatrist asked him, well, did they talk to you, John? What did they say? That, of course, a very facetious comment, and it brought a good laugh from the press corps assembled here in this very warm press tent. So ends phase number two of ABC Radio's coverage of Lieutenant Colonel John Glenn's history-making orbital flight. They might well be categorized as welcome and return of the astronaut, a heartwarming reunion with his family, triumphal parade through Cocoa Beach, home of the astronaut, meeting with and commendation from the President of the United States, and finally, this information-packed news conference where America's first astronaut had rapt attention from the 500 to 600 newsmen assembled here in the tent. Phase two, the welcome of the astronaut, continues with the official parade down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. on Monday, along with his appearance before a joint session of Congress. Most of these same ABC radio stations will bring you full coverage of that event starting on Monday morning. Arthur Van Horn and our entire ABC radio space team will be there to fill you in on all of the pageantry and color of this historic moment. Well, that wraps up our ABC radio coverage from Cape Canaveral, where the entire press corps stood by for 5 weeks, at least 5 weeks, a period that will go down in news history as the long wait. With the longest wait in modern news coverage, many of the reporters became bored at times. But from the time of launch on Tuesday morning, there wasn't a man here who didn't agree that it was certainly well worthwhile. A fitting ending to an epic-making chapter in United States history. I, for one, am happy and proud to have watched on the sidelines. This is Tom O'Brien, ABC, Cape Canaveral.
This is the ABC Radio Network.